It disintegrated, and the fine red hair spilled loose across my lap. "Jamie," I said, and my voice was shaking too. "Jamie, you can't kill Jack Randall." One corner of his mouth twitched, very slightly.
"I dinna ken whether to be touched at your concern for my safety, or to be offended at your lack of confidence. But in either case, you need no worry. I can kill him. Easily."
The last word was spoken quietly, with an underlying tone that mingled venom with satisfaction. "It isn't what I meant. Jamie!"
"Fortunately," he went on,
as though not hearing me,
"Randall has proof that he was at the Duke's residence all during the evening of the rape. As soon as the police finish interviewing the guests who were present and satisfy themselves that Randall is innocent, of that charge at least, then he'll be let go. I shall stay at the inn until he's free. And then I shall find him."
His eyes were fixed on the wardrobe, but plainly he was seeing something else.
"He'll be waiting for me," he said softly.
He stuffed the shirts and linen into a travelling bag and slung his cloak over his arm. He was turning to go through the door when I sprang up from the bed and caught him by the sleeve. "Jamie, for God's sake, Jamie, listen to me. You can't kill Jack Randall because I won't let you." He stared down at me in utter astonishment. "Because of Frank," I said. I let go of his sleeve and stepped back.
"Frank," he repeated,
shaking his head slightly as though to clear a buzzing in his ears.
"Frank?"
"Yes," I said. "If you kill Jack Randall now, then Frank, he won't exist. He won't be born. Jamie, you can't kill an innocent man." His face, normally a pale ruddy bronze, had faded to a blotchy white as I spoke. Now the red began to rise again, burning the tips of his ears and flaming in his cheeks.
"An innocent man?
Frank is an innocent man. I don't care about Jack Randall."
"Well, I do."
He snatched up the bag and strode toward the door, cloak streaming over one arm.
"Jesus, God, Claire. You try to stop me taking my vengeance on the man who made me play whore to him, who forced me to my knees and made me suck his cock smeared with my own blood? Christ, Claire!"
He flung the door open with a crash and was in the hallway by the time I could reach him. It had grown dark by now, but the servants had lit the candles and the hallway was aglow with soft light. I grasped him by the arm and yanked at him. "Jamie, please!" He jerked his arm impatiently out of my grasp. I was almost crying, but held back the tears. I caught the bag and pulled it out of his hand. "Please, Jamie, wait, just for a year. The child, Randall's, it'll be conceived next December. After that, it won't matter. But please, for my sake, Jamie, wait that long." The candelabra on the gilt-edged table threw his shadow huge and wavering against the far wall. He stared up at it, hands clenched, as though facing a giant, blank-faced and menacing, that towered above him.
"Aye," he whispered, as though to himself. "I'm a big chap, big and strong. I can stand a lot. Yes, I can stand it."
He whirled on me, shouting.
"I can stand a lot, but just because I can, does that mean I must? Do I have to bear everyone's weakness? Can I not have my own?"
He began to pace up and down the hall, the shadow following in silent frenzy.
"You cannot ask it of me. You, you of all people, you who knew what...
He choked, speechless with rage. He hit the stone wall of the passage repeatedly as he walked, smashing the side of his fist viciously into the limestone wall. The stone swallowed each blow in soundless violence. He turned back and came to a halt facing me, breathing heavily.
I stood stock still, afraid to move or speak. He nodded once or twice, rapidly, as though making up his mind about something, then drew the dirk from his belt with a hiss, and held it in front of my nose. With a visible effort, he spoke calmly.
"You may have your choice, Claire. Him or me."
The candle flames danced in the polished metal as he turned the knife slowly.
"I cannot live while he lives. If you will not have me kill him, then kill me now, yourself."
He grabbed my hand and forced my fingers around the handle of the dirk. Ripping the lacy jabot open, he bared his throat and yanked my hand upward, fingers hard around my own. I pulled back with all my strength, but he forced the tip of the blade against the soft hollow above the collarbone, just below the livid cicatrice that Randall's own knife had left there years before.
"Jamie, stop it! Stop it right now!"
I brought my other hand down on his wrist as hard as I could, jarring his grip enough to jerk my fingers free. The knife clattered to the floor, bouncing from the stones to a quiet landing on a corner of the leafy Oberson carpet. With that clarity of vision for small details that afflicts life's most awful moments, I saw that the blade lay stark across the curling stem of a bunch of fat green grapes, as though about to sever it and cut them free of the weft to roll at our feet. He stood frozen before me, face white as bone, eyes burning. I gripped his arm, hard as wood beneath my fingers.
"Please believe me. Please.
I wouldn't do this if there were any other way." I took a deep, quivering breath to quell the leaping pulse beneath my ribs.
"You owe me your life, Jamie. Not once, twice over. I saved you from hanging at Wentworth, and when you had fever at the Abbey. You owe me a life, Jamie."
He stared down at me for a long moment before answering. When he did, his voice was quiet again, with an edge of bitterness.
"I see. And you'll claim your debt now."
His eyes burned with the clear, deep blue that burns in the heart of a flame.
"I have to. I can't make you see reason any other way."
"Reason? Ah, reason. No, I canna say that reason is anything I see just now."
He folded his arms behind his back, gripping the stiff fingers of his right hand with the curled ones of his left. He walked slowly away from me, down the endless hall, head bowed. The passage was lined with paintings, some lighted from below by torchere or candelabra, some from above by the gilded sconces. A few, less favoured, skulked in the darkness between. Jamie walked slowly between them, glancing up now and again as though in converse with the wigged and painted gallery. The hall ran the length of the second floor, carpeted and tapestried, with enormous stained-glass windows set into the walls at either end of the corridor. He walked all the way to the far end, then, wheeling with the precision of a soldier on parade, all the way back, still at a slow and formal pace, down and back, again and again. My legs trembling, I subsided into a fauteuil near the end of the passage. Once one of the omnipresent servants approached obsequiously to ask if Madame required wine or perhaps a biscuit. I waved him away with what politeness I could muster, and waited. At last he came to a halt before me, feet planted wide apart in silver-buckled shoes, hands still clasped behind his back. He waited for me to look up at him before he spoke. His face was set, with no twitch of agitation to betray him, though the lines near his eyes were deep with strain.
"A year, then," was all he said.
He turned at once, and was several feet away by the time I struggled out of the deep green velvet chair. I had barely gained my feet when he suddenly whirled back past me, reached the huge stained-glass window in 3 strides, and smashed his right hand through it.
The window was made up of thousands of tiny coloured panes held in place by strips of melted lead. Though the entire window, a mythological scene of the judgment of Paris, shuddered in its frame, the leading held most of the panes intact. In spite of the crash and tinkle, only a jagged hole at the feet of Aphrodite let in the soft spring air. Jamie stood a moment, pressing both hands tight into his midriff. A dark red stain grew on the frilled cuff, lacy as a bridal shirt. He brushed past me once again as I moved toward him, and stalked away, unspeaking. I collapsed once more into the armchair, hard enough to make a small puff of dust rise from the plush. I lay there limp, eyes closed, feeling the cool night breeze wash over me. The hair was damp at my temples, and I could feel my pulse, quick as a bird's, racing at the base of my throat. Would he ever forgive me? My heart clenched like a fist at the memory of the knowledge of betrayal in his eyes. "How could you ask it?" he had said. You who know. Yes, I knew. And I thought the knowing might tear me from Jamie as I had been torn from Frank. But whether Jamie could forgive me or not, I could never forgive myself if I condemned an innocent man, and one I had once loved. "The sins of the fathers," I murmured to myself. "The sins of the fathers shall not be visited upon the children." "Madame?" I jumped, opening my eyes to find an equally startled chambermaid backing away. I put a hand to my pounding heart, gasping for air. "Madame, you are unwell. Shall I fetch—" "No," I said, as firmly as I could. "I am quite well. I wish to sit here for a time. Please go away." The girl seemed only too anxious to oblige. "Oui, madame," she said, and vanished down the corridor, leaving me gazing blankly at a scene of amorous love in a garden hanging on the opposite wall. Suddenly cold, I drew up the folds of the cloak I had had no time to shed, and closed my eyes again. It was past midnight when I went at last to our bedroom. Jamie was there, seated before a small table, apparently watching a pair of lace wings fluttering dangerously round the single candlestick, which was all the light there was in the room. I dropped my cape on the floor and went toward him.
"Don't touch me," he said. "Go to bed."
He spoke almost abstractedly, but I halted in my tracks.
"But your hand," I started.
"That doesn't matter. Go to bed," he repeated.
The knuckles of his right hand were laced with blood, and the cuff of his shirt was stiff with it. But I wouldn't have dared touch him then, had he had a knife stuck in his belly. I left him staring at the death dance of the lace wings, and went to bed. I woke sometime near dawn, with the first light of the coming day fuzzing the outlines of the furniture in the room. Through the double doors to the anteroom, I could see Jamie as I had left him, still seated at the table. Now the candle was burnt out, the lace wings gone, and he sat with his head in his hands, fingers furrowed in the brutally cropped hair. The light stole all colour from the room. Even the hair spiking up like flames between his fingers was quenched to the colour of ashes. I slid out of bed, cold in the thin embroidered nightdress. He didn't turn as I came up behind him, but he knew I was there. When I touched his hand, he let it drop to the table and allowed his head to fall back until it rested just below my breasts. He sighed deeply as I rubbed it, and I felt the tension begin to go out of him. My hands worked their way down over neck and shoulders, feeling the chill of his flesh through the thin linen. Finally, I came around in front of him. He reached up and grasped me around the waist, pulling me to him, and burying his head in my nightdress, just above the round swell of the unborn child. "I'm cold," I said at last, very softly. Will you come and warm me? After a moment, he nodded and stumbled blindly to his feet. I led him to bed, stripped him as he sat unresisting, and tucked him under the quilts. I lay in the curve of his arm, pressed tight against him, until the chill of his skin had faded, and we lay ensconced in a pocket of soft warmth. Tentatively, I laid a hand on his chest, stroking lightly back and forth until the nipple stood up, a tiny nub of desire. He laid his hand over mine, stilling it. I was afraid he would push me away, and he did, but only so that he could roll toward me. The light was growing stronger, and he spent a long time just looking down at my face, stroking it from temple to chin, drawing his thumb down the line of my throat and out along the wing of my collarbone.
"God, I do love you," he whispered, as though to himself.
He kissed me, preventing response, and circling one breast with his maimed right hand, prepared to take me.
"But your hand,"
I said, for the second time that night.
"It doesn't matter," he said, for the second time that night.
Part 4. Skåndal. Chapter 22. The Royal Stud. The coach bumped slowly over a particularly bad stretch of road, one left pitted and holed by the winter freeze and the beating of spring rains. It had been a wet year. Even now, in early summer, there were moist, boggy patches under the lush growth of gooseberry bushes by the sides of the road. Jamie sat beside me on the narrow padded bench that formed one seat of the coach. Fergus sprawled in the corner of the other bench, asleep, and the motion of the coach made his head rock and sway like the head of a mechanical doll with a spring for its neck. The air in the coach was warm, and dust came through the windows in small golden spurts whenever we hit a patch of dry earth. We had talked desultorily at first of the surrounding countryside, of the royal stables at Argenton for which we were headed, of the small bits of gossip that composed the daily fare of conversation in court and business circles. I might have slept too, lulled by the coach's rhythm and the warmth of the day, but the changing contours of my body made sitting in one position uncomfortable, and my back ached from the jolting. The baby was becoming increasingly active too, and the small flutters of the first movements had developed into definite small pokes and proddings, pleasant in their own fashion, but distracting.
"Perhaps you should have stayed at home, Sassnach," Jamie said, frowning slightly as I twisted, adjusting my position yet again.
"I'm all right," I said with a smile. "Just twitchy. And it would have been a shame to miss all this." I waved at the coach window, where the broad sweep of field shone green as emeralds between the windbreak rows of dark, straight poplars. Dusty or not, the fresh air of the countryside was rich and intoxicating after the close, fetid smells of the city and the medicinal stenches of l'Hôpital des Anges. Louis had agreed, as a gesture of cautious amity toward the English diplomatic overtures, to allow the Duke of Sandringham to purchase 4 Percheron broodmares from the royal stud at Argenton, with which to improve the bloodlines of the small herd of draft horses which His Grace maintained in England. His Grace was therefore visiting Argenton today, and had invited Jamie along to give advice on which mares should be chosen. The invitation was given at an evening party, and one thing leading to another, the visit had ended up as a full-scale picnic expedition, involving 4 coaches and several of the ladies and gentlemen of the court.
"It's a good sign, don't you think?"
I asked with a cautious glance to be sure our companions were indeed fast asleep. "Louis giving the Duke permission to buy horses, I mean. If he's making gestures toward the English, then he's presumably not inclined to be sympathetic to Jane Stewart, at least not openly." Jamie shook his head. He declined absolutely to wear a wig, and the bold, clean shape of his polled head had occasioned no little excitement at court.
It had its advantages at the present moment. While a faint sheen of perspiration glowed on the bridge of his long, straight nose, he wasn't nearly as wilted as I.
No, I'm fairly sure now that Louis means to have nothing to do with the Stuarts, at least so far as any move toward restoration goes. Monsieur Duvigny assures me that the Council is entirely opposed to any such thing. While Louis may eventually yield to the Pope's urging so far as to make Charles a small allowance, he isn't disposed to bring the Stuarts into any kind of prominence in France, with Geordie of England looking over his shoulder.
He wore his plaid today, pinned with a brooch at the shoulder. A beautiful thing his sister had sent him from Scotland, made in the shape of two running stags, bodies bent so that they joined in a circle, heads and tails touching. He pulled up a fold of the plaid and wiped his face with it.
I think I've spoken with every banker in Paris of any substance over the last months, and they are united in basic disinterest.
He smiled wryly.
Money's none so plentiful that anyone wants to back a dicey proposition like the Stuart Restoration.
And that, I said, stretching my back with a groan, leaves Spain.
Jamie nodded.
It does. And Dougal Mackenzie.
He looked smug, and I sat up, intrigued. Have you heard from him?
Despite an initial wariness, Dougal had accepted Jamie as a devoted fellow Jacobite, and the usual crop of coded letters had been augmented by a series of discreet communications sent by Dougal from Spain, meant to be read by Jamie and passed on to Charles Stuart.
I have indeed.
I could tell from his expression that it was good news, and it was, though not for the Stuarts.
Philip has declined to lend any assistance to the Stuarts, Jamie said. He's had word from the people office, you can. He's to keep a war from the whole question of the Scottish throne.
Do we know why?
The latest interception from a papal messenger had contained several letters, but as these were all addressed to James or Charles Stuart, they might well contain no reference to His Holiness's conversations with Spain.
Dougal thinks he knows.
Jamie laughed.
He's fair disgusted as Dougal.
Said he'd been kept cooling his heels in Toledo for nearly a month, and sent to war at last with no more than a vague promise of aid in the fullness of time. Deo volente.
His deep voice captured a pious intonation perfectly, and I laughed myself.
Benedict wants to avoid friction between Spain and France. He doesn't want Philip and Louis wasting money that he might have a use for, you can, he added cynically. It's hardly fitting for a pope to see so, but Benedict has his doubts as to whether a Catholic king could hold England any more. Scotland's got its Catholic chiefs among the Highland clans, but it's some time since England owned a Catholic king. Like to be the hell of a lot longer before they do again.
Deo volente,
he added, grinning. He scratched his head, ruffling the short red-gold hair above his temple.
That looks very dim for the Stuart, Sassenach, and that's good news. No, there'll be no aid from the Bourbon monarchs. The only thing that concerns me now is this investment Charles Stuart's made with the Comte Saint-Germain.
You don't think it's just a business arrangement, then?
Well, it is,
he said, frowning.
And yet there's more behind it. I've heard talk, eh?
While the banking families of Paris were not inclined to take the young pretender to the throne of Scotland with any seriousness, that situation might easily change were Charles Stuart suddenly to have money to invest.
His Highness tells me he's been talking to the goblins, Jamie said. Saint-Germain introduced him, otherwise they'd not give him the time of day. An old goblin thinks him a wastrel and a fool, and so does one of the goblin's sons. The other, though, he says that he'll wait and see. If Charles succeeds with this venture, then perhaps he can put other opportunities in his way.
Not good, I observed. Jamie shook his head.
No. Money breeds money again. Let him succeed at one or two large ventures, and the bankers will begin to listen to him.
"The man's no great thinker," he said, with a wry twist of his mouth, "but he's very charming in person. He can persuade people into things against their better judgment. Even so, he'll make no headway without a small bit of capital to his name. But he'll have that if this investment succeeds."
"Hmm." I shifted my position once more, wriggling my toes in their hot leather prison. The shoes had fit when made for me, but my feet were beginning to swell a bit, and my silk stockings were damp with sweat. "Is there anything we can do about it?" Jamie shrugged with a lopsided smile.
"Pray for bad weather off Portugal, I suppose. Beyond the ship sinking, I dinna see much way for the venture to fail, truth be told. Saint-Germain has contracts already for the sale of the entire cargo. Both he and Charles Stewart stand to triple their money."
I shivered briefly at the mention of the Comte. I couldn't help recalling Dougal's speculations. I hadn't told Jamie about Dougal's visit, nor about his speculations as to the Comte's nocturnal activities. I didn't like keeping secrets from him, but Dougal had demanded my silence as his price for helping me in the matter of Jonathan Randall, and I had had little choice but to agree. Jamie smiled suddenly at me and stretched out a hand.
"I'll think of something, Sassenach. For now, give me your feet. Jenny said it helped to have me rub her feet when she was wee child."
I didn't argue, but slipped my feet out of the hot shoes and swung them up into his lap with a sigh of relief as the air from the window cooled the damp silk over my toes. His hands were big, and his fingers at once strong and gentle. He rubbed his knuckles down the arch of my foot, and I leaned back with a soft moan. We rode silently for several minutes while I relaxed into a state of mindless bliss. Head bent over my green silk toes, Jamie remarked casually,
"It wasn't really a debt, you ken."
"What wasn't?" Fogged as I was by warm sun and foot massage, I hadn't any idea what he meant. Not stopping his rubbing, he looked up at me. His expression was serious, though the hint of a smile lit his eyes.
"You said that I owed you a life, Sassenach, because you'd saved mine for me."
He took hold of one big toe and wiggled it.
"But I've been reckoning, and I'm none so sure that's true. Seems to me that it's nearly even, taken all in all."
"What do you mean, even?" I tried to pull my foot loose, but he held tight.
"If you've saved my life, and you have, well, I've saved yours as well, and at least as often. I saved you from Jack Randall at Fort William, you'll recall, and I took you from the mob at Crane's Muir, no?"
"Yes," I said cautiously. I had no idea where he was going, but he wasn't just making idle conversation. "I'm grateful for it, of course." He made a small Scottish noise of dismissal deep in his throat.
"'Tis no matter for gratitude, Sassenach, on your part or mine. My point is only that it's no a matter of obligation either."
The smile had vanished from his eyes, and he was entirely serious.
"I didn't give you Randall's life as an exchange for my own. It wouldn't be a fair trade for one thing. Close your mouth, Sassenach," he added practically. "Flies will get in."
There were, in fact, a number of the insects present. Three were resting on Fergus's shirt front, undisturbed by its constant rise and fall. "Why did you agree, then?" I stopped struggling, and he wrapped both hands around my feet, running his thumbs slowly over the curves of my heels.
"Well, it wasn't for any other reasons you tried to make me see." "As for Frank," he said, "well, it's true enough that I've taken his wife. And I do pity him for it, more sometimes than others," he added, with an impudent quirk of one eyebrow. "Still, is it any different than if he were my rival here? You had free choice between us, and you chose me, even with such luxuries as hot baths thrown in on his side. Oof!" I jerked one foot loose and drove it into his ribs. He straightened up and grabbed it in time to prevent me repeating the blow.
"Regretting your choice, are you?"
"Not yet," I said, struggling to repossess my foot. "But I may any minute. Keep talking." "Well, then,
I couldn't see that the fact that you picked me entitled Frank Randall to particular consideration." "Besides," he said frankly, "I'll admit to being just a wee bit jealous of the man."
I kicked with my other foot, aiming lower. He caught that one before it landed, twisting my ankle skillfully.
"As for owing him his life on general principles," he continued, ignoring my attempts to escape, "that's an argument Brother Anselm at the Abbey could answer better than I. Certainly I wouldn't kill an innocent man in cold blood. But there again, I've killed men in battle. And is this different?"
I remembered the soldier and the boy in the snow that I had killed in our escape from Wentworth. I no longer tormented myself with memories of them, but I knew they would never leave me. He shook his head.
"No, there are a good many arguments you might make about that. But in the end, such choices come down to one. You kill when you must, and you live with it after. I remember the face of every man I've killed, and I always will. But the fact remains, I am alive, and they are not. And that is my only justification, whether it be right or no."
"But that's not true in this case," I pointed out. "It isn't a case of kill or be killed." He shook his head, dislodging a fly that had settled on his hair.
"Now, there you're wrong, Sassenach. What it is that lies between Jack Randall and me will be settled only when one of us is dead, and maybe not then. There are ways of killing other than with a knife or a gun, and there are things worse than physical death."
His tone softened.
"In St. Anne, you pulled me back from more than one kind of death, Modunia, and never think I don't know it."
He shook his head.
"Perhaps I do owe you more than you owe me, after all."
He let go my feet and rearranged his long legs.
"And that leads me to consider your conscience as well as mine. After all, you had no idea what would happen when you made your choice. And it's one thing to abandon a man, and another to condemn him to death."
I didn't at all like this manner of describing my actions, but I couldn't shirk the facts. I had, in fact, abandoned Frank, and while I couldn't regret the choice I had made, still I did, and always would, regret its necessity. Jamie's next words echoed my thoughts eerily. He continued,
"If you had known it might mean Frank's, well, his death, shall we say, perhaps you would have chosen differently. Given that you did choose me, have I the right to make your actions of more consequence than you intended?"
Absorbed in his argument, he had been oblivious of its effect on me. Catching sight of my face now, he stopped suddenly, watching me in silence as we jostled our way through the greens of the countryside.
"I dinna see how it can have been a sin for you to do as you did, Claire," he said at last,
reaching out to lay a hand on my stockinged foot.
"I am your lawful husband, as much as he ever was, or will be. You do not even know that you could have returned to him. Modunia, you might have gone still further back, or gone forward to a different time altogether. You acted as you thought you must, and no one can do better than that."
He looked up, and the look in his eyes pierced my soul.
"I'm honest enough to say that I dinna care what the right and wrong of it may be, so long as you are here with me, Claire," he said softly. "If it was a sin for you to choose me, then I would go to the devil himself and bless him for tempting you to it."
He lifted my foot and gently kissed the tip of my big toe. I laid my hand on his head. The short hair felt bristly but soft, like a very young hedgehog. "I don't think it was wrong," I said softly. "But if it was, Then I'll go to the devil with you, Jamie Fraser. He closed his eyes and bowed his head over my foot. He held it so tightly that I could feel the long, slender metatarsals pressed together. Still, I didn't pull back. I dug my fingers into his scalp and tugged his hair gently.
Why then, Jamie? Why did you decide to let Jack Randall live?
He still gripped my foot, but opened his eyes and smiled at me.
Well, I thought a number of things, Sassenach, as I walked up and down that evening. For one thing, I thought that you would suffer if I did kill the filthy scut. I would do, or not do, quite a few things to spare you distress, Sassenach. But how heavily does your conscience weigh against my honour?
No. He shook his head again, disposing of another point.
Each one of us can be responsible only for his own actions and his own conscience. What I do cannot be laid to your account, no matter what the effects.
He blinked, eyes watering from the dusty wind, and passed a hand across his hair in a vain attempt to smooth the dishevelled ends. Clipped short, the spikes of a cowlick stood up on the crest of his skull in a defiant spray.
"Why, then?" I demanded, leaning forward. "You've told me all the reasons why not. What's left?"
He hesitated for a moment, but then met my eyes squarely.
"Because of Charles Stuart, Sassenach? So far we have stopped all the Earths, but with this investment of his, well, he might yet succeed in leading an army in Scotland. And if so, well, you ken better than I do what may come, Sassenach."
I did, and the thought turned me cold. I couldn't help remembering one historian's description of the Highlanders' fate at Culloden. The dead lay four deep, soaking in rain and their own blood. The Highlanders, mismanaged and starving, but ferocious to the end, would be wasted in one decisive half-hour. They would be left to lie in heaps, bleeding in a cold April rain, the cause they had cherished for 100 years dead along with them. Jamie reached forward suddenly and took my hands.
"I think it will not happen, Claire. I think we may stop him. And if not, then still I dinna expect anything to happen to me. But if it should..."
He was in deadly earnest now, speaking soft and urgently.
"If it does, then I want there to be a place for you. I want someone for you to go to if I am not there to care for you. If it canna be me, then I would have it be a man who loves you."
His grasp on my fingers grew tighter. I could feel both rings digging into my flesh and felt the urgency in his hands.
"Claire, you know what it cost me to do this for you, to spare Randall's life. Promise me that if the time should come, you'll go back to Frank."
His eyes searched my face, deep blue as the sky in the window behind him.
"I tried to send you back twice before, and I thank God you wouldna go. But if it comes to a third time, then promise me you will go back to him. Back to Frank. For that is why I spared Jack Randall for a year. For your sake. Promise me, Claire." "Allez! Allez! Montez!"
the coachman shouted from above, encouraging the team up a slope. We were nearly there.
"All right," I said at last. "I promise."
The stables at Argenton were clean and airy, redolent of summer and the smell of horses. In an open box stall, Jamie circled a Percheron mare, enamoured as a horsefly.
"Ooh, what a bonny wee lass ye are. Come here, sweetheart. Let me see that beautiful fat rump. Aye, that's grand.
I wish my husband would talk that way to me," remarked the Duchesse de Neve, provoking giggles from the other ladies of the party, who stood in the straw of the central aisle watching.
Perhaps he would, madame, if your own back view provided such stimulation. But then, perhaps your husband does not share my Lord Brochturach's appreciation for a finely shaped rump.
The Comte Saint-Germain allowed his eyes to drift over me with a hint of contemptuous amusement. I tried to imagine those black eyes gleaming through the slits of a mask, and succeeded only too well. Unfortunately, the lace of his wrist frills fell well past his knuckles. I couldn't see the fork of his thumb. Catching the byplay, Jamie leaned comfortably on the mare's broad back, only his head, shoulders, and forearms showing above the bulk of the Percheron.
"My Lord Brochturach appreciates beauty wherever it may be encountered, Monsieur le Comte, in animal or woman. Unlike some I might name, though, I am capable of telling the difference between the two."
He grinned maliciously at Saint-Germain, then patted the mare's neck in farewell as the party broke out laughing. Jamie took my arm to lead me toward the next stable, followed more slowly by the rest of the party.
"Ah," he said,
inhaling the mixture of horse, harness, manure, and hay, as though it were incense.
"I do miss the smell of a stable, and the country makes me sick for Scotland." "Doesn't look a lot like Scotland," I said, squinting in the bright sun as we emerged from the dimness of the stable. "No, but it's country," he said. "It's clean and it's green, and there's nae smoke in the air or sewage underfoot, unless you count horse dung, which I don't."
The sun of early summer shone on the roofs of Argenton, nestled among gently rolling green hills. The royal stud was just outside the town, much more solidly constructed than the houses of the king's subjects nearby. The barns and stables were of quarried stone, stone-floored, slate-roofed, and maintained in a condition of cleanliness that surpassed that of l'Hôpital des Anges by a fair degree. A loud whooping came from behind the corner of the stable, and Jamie stopped short, just in time to avoid Fergus, who shot out in front of us as though fired from a slingshot, hotly pursued by two stable lads, both a good deal bigger. A dirty green streak of fresh manure down the side of the first boy's face gave some clue as to the cause of the altercation. With considerable presence of mind, Fergus doubled on his tracks, shot past his pursuers, and whizzed into the middle of the party, whence he took refuge behind the bulwark of Jamie's kilted hips. Seeing their prey thus safely gone to earth, his pursuers glanced fearfully at the oncoming phalanx of courtiers and gowns, exchanged a look of decision, and, as one, turned and loped off. Seeing them go, Fergus stuck his head out from behind my skirt and yelled something in gutter French that earned him a sharp cuff on the ear from Jamie. "Off wi' ye," he said brusquely, "and for God's sake dinna be throwing horse apples at people bigger than you are. Now go and keep out of trouble." He followed up this advice with a healthy smack on the seat of the breeches that sent Fergus staggering off in the opposite direction to that taken by his erstwhile assailants. I had been of two minds as to the wisdom of taking Fergus with us on this expedition, but most of the ladies were bringing page-boys with them to run errands and carry the baskets of food and other paraphernalia deemed essential to a day's outing. And Jamie had wanted to show the lad a bit of country, feeling that he'd earned a holiday. All well and good, except that Fergus, who had never been outside Paris in his life, had got the exhilaration of air, light, and beautiful huge animals right up his nose, and, demented with excitement, had been in constant trouble since our arrival. "God knows what he'll do next," I said darkly, looking after Fergus's retreating form. "Set one of the hayricks on fire, I expect." Jamie was unperturbed at the suggestion. "He'll be all right. All lads get into manure fights."
"They do?"
I turned around, scrutinising Saint-Germain, immaculate in white linen, white serge, and white silk, bending courteously to listen to the Duchesse as she minced slowly across the straw-strewn yard.
"Maybe you did," I said.
"Not him."
"Not the Bishop either, I don't think." I was wondering whether this excursion had been a good idea, at least on my part. Jamie was in his element with the giant Percherons, and the Duke was clearly impressed with him, which was all to the good. On the other hand, my back ached miserably from the carriage ride, and my feet felt hot and swollen, pressing painfully against the tight leather of my shoes. Jamie looked down at me and smiled, pressing my hand where it lay on his arm.
Not so long now, Sassenach. The guide wants to show us the breeding sheds, and then you and the other ladies can go and sit down with the food, while the men stand about making crude jests about the size of each other's cock.
Is that the general effect of watching horses bred? I asked, fascinated.
Well, on men it is. I dinna ken what it does to ladies. Keep an ear out, and you can tell me later.
There was, in fact, an air of suppressed excitement among the members of the party as we all pressed into the rather cramped quarters of a breeding shed. Stone, like the other buildings, this one was equipped not with partitioned stalls down both sides, but with a small fenced pen with holding stalls at either side, and a sort of chute or runway along the back, with several gates that could be opened or closed to control a horse's movement. The building itself was light and airy, owing to huge unglazed windows that opened at either end, giving a view of a grassy paddock outside. I could see several of the enormous Percheron mares grazing near the edge of this. One or two seemed restless, breaking into a rocking gallop for a few paces, then dropping back to a trot or a walk, shaking heads and manes with a high whinnying noise. Once, when this happened, there was a loud nasal scream from one of the holding stalls at the end of the shed, and the panelling shook with the thud of a mighty kick from its inhabitant.
"He's ready," a voice murmured appreciatively behind me. "I wonder which is the lucky mamselle."
"The one nearest the gate," the Duchesse suggested, always ready to wager. 5 livres on that one."
"I know, you're wrong, madame. She's too calm. It will be the little one, under the apple tree, rolling her eyes like a coquette. See how she tosses her head? That one's my choice."
The mares had all stopped at the sound of the stallion's cry, lifting inquiring noses and flicking their ears nervously. The restless ones tossed their heads and whickered. One stretched her neck and let out a long, high call.
"That one," Jamie said quietly, nodding at her. "Hear her call him." "And what is she saying, my lord?" the bishop asked, a glint in his eye.
Jamie shook his head solemnly.
"It is a song, my lord, but one that a man of the cloth is deaf to, or should be," he added, to gales of laughter.
Sure enough, it was the mare who had called who was chosen. Once inside, she stopped dead, head up, and stood testing the air with flaring nostrils. The stallion could smell her. His cries echoed eerily off the timbered roof, so loud that conversation was impossible.
No one wanted to talk now, anyway.
Uncomfortable as I was, I could feel the quick tingle of arousal through my breasts and a tightening of my swollen belly as the mare once more answered the stallion's call. Percherons are very large horses. A big one stands over 5 feet at the shoulder, and the rump of a well-fed mare is almost a yard across, a pale dappled grey or shining black, adorned with a waterfall of black hair thick as my arm at the root of it. The stallion burst from his stall toward the tethered mare with a suddenness that made everyone fall back from the fence. Puffs of dirt flew up in clouds as the huge hoofs struck the padded dirt of the pen, and drops of saliva flew from his open mouth. The groom who had opened his stall door jumped aside, tiny and insignificant next to the magnificent fury let loose in the pen. The mare curvetted and squealed in alarm, but then he was on her, and his teeth closed on the sturdy arch of her neck, forcing her head down into submission. The great swathe of her tail swept high, leaving her naked, exposed to his lust.
"Jesus," whispered Monsieur Prudhomme.
It took very little time. but it seemed a lot longer watching the heaving of sweat-darkened flanks and the play of light on swirling hair and the sheen of great muscles, tense and straining in the flexible agony of mating. Everyone was very quiet as we left the shed. Finally, the Duke laughed, nudged Jamie, and said,
"You are accustomed to such sights, my Lord Brochturoch."
"Aye," Jamie answered. "I've seen it a good many times."
"Ah," the Duke said. "And tell me, my lord, how does the sight make you feel after so many times?"
One corner of Jamie's mouth twitched as he replied, but he remained otherwise straight-faced.
"Very modest, Your Grace," he said. "What a sight," the Duchesse de Neve said.
She broke a biscuit, dreamy-eyed, and munched it slowly.
"So arousing, was it not?" "What a prick, you mean," said Madame Prudhomme, rather coarsely. "I wish Philibert had one like that."
"As it is."
She cocked an eyebrow toward a plate of tiny sausages, each perhaps 2 inches long, and the ladies seated on the picnic cloth broke into giggles.
"A bit of chicken, please, Paul," said the Comtesse Saint-Germain to her page-boy. She was young, and the bawdy conversation of the older ladies was making her blush. I wondered just what sort of marriage she had with Saint-Germain.
He never took her out in public, save on occasions like this, where the presence of the bishop prevented his appearing with one of his mistresses.
"Bah!" said Madame Montresor, one of the ladies-in-waiting whose husband was a friend of the bishop's. "Size isn't everything. What difference if it's the size of a stallion's, if he lasts no longer than one?" "Less than 2 minutes?
I ask you, what good is that?"
She held up a cornichon between two fingers and delicately licked the tiny pale green pickle, the pink tip of her tongue pointed and dainty.
"It isn't what they have in their breeches, I say. It's what they do with it."
Madame Prudhomme snorted.
"Well, if you find one who knows how to do anything with it but poke it into the nearest hole, tell me. I would be interested to see what else can be done with a thing like that."
"At least you have one who's interested," broke in the Duchesse de Neve.
She cast a glance of disgust at her husband, huddled with the other men near one of the paddocks, watching a harnessed mare being put through her paces.
"Not tonight, my dearest."
She imitated the sonorous nasal tones of her husband to perfection.
"I am fatigued."
She put a hand to her brow and rolled her eyes up.
"The press of business is so wearing."
Encouraged by the giggles, she went on with her imitation, now widening her eyes in horror and crossing her hands protectively over her lap.
"What? Again? Do you not know that to expend the male essence gratuitously is to court ill health? Is it not enough that your demands have worn me to a nubbin, Mathilde? Do you wish me to have an attack?"
The ladies cackled and screeched with laughter, loud enough to attract the attention of the bishop, who waved at us and smiled indulgently, provoking further gales of hilarity.
"Well, at least he's not expending all his male essence in brothels or elsewhere," said Madame Prudhomme, with an eloquently pitying glance at the Comtesse Saint-Germain.
"No," said Mathilde gloomily, "he hoards it as though it were gold.
You'd think there was no more to be had, the way he—"
"Oh, Your Grace, will you not have a cup of wine?"
She smiled charmingly up at the Duke, who had approached quietly from behind. He stood smiling at the ladies, one fair brow slightly arched. If he had heard the subject of our conversation, he gave no sign of it. Seating himself beside me on the cloth, His Grace made casual, witty conversation with the ladies, his oddly high-pitched voice forming no contrast to theirs. While he seemed to pay close attention to the conversation, I noticed that his eyes strayed periodically to the small cluster of men who stood by the paddock fence. Jamie's kilt was bright even amid the gorgeous cut velvets and stiffened silk. I had had some hesitation in meeting the Duke again. After all, our last visit had ended in the arrest of Jonathan Randall, upon my accusation of attempted rape. But the Duke had been all charming urbanity on this outing, with no mention of either of the Randall brothers. Neither had there been any public mention of the arrest. Whatever the Duke's diplomatic activities, they seemed to rank highly enough to merit a royal seal of silence. On the whole, I welcomed the Duke's presence at the picnic cloth. For one thing, his presence kept the ladies from asking me, as some bold souls did every so often, at parties, whether it was true about what Scotsmen wore beneath their kilts. Given the mood of the present party, I didn't think my customary reply of, "Oh, the usual," would suffice. "Your husband has a fine eye for horses," the Duke observed to me, freed for a moment when the Duchesse de Nerve, on his other side, leaned across the cloth to talk to Madame Prudhomme. "He tells me that both his father and his uncle kept small but quite fine stables in the Highlands." "Yes, that's true," I sipped my wine. "But you visited Colum Mackenzie at Castle Leoch. Surely you've seen his stable for yourself." I had, in fact, first met the Duke at Leoch the year before, though the meeting had been brief. He had left on a hunting expedition shortly before I was arrested for witchcraft. I thought surely he must have known about that. But if so, he gave no sign of it. "Of course." The Duke's small, shrewd blue eyes darted left, then right, to see whether he was observed, then shifted into English. "At the time, your husband informed me that he did not reside upon his own estates, owing to an unfortunate and mistaken charge of murder laid against him by the English Crown. I wondered, my lady, whether that charge of outlawry still holds?" "There's still a price on his head," I said bluntly. The Duke's expression of polite interest didn't change. He reached absently for one of the small sausages on the platter. "That is not an irremediable matter," he said quietly. "After my encounter with your husband at Leoch, I made some inquiries—" "Oh, suitably discreet, I assure you, my dear lady. And I think that the matter might be arranged without undue difficulty, given a word in the right ear from the right sources." This was interesting. Jamie had first told the Duke of Sandringham about his outlawry at Colum Mackenzie's suggestion, in the hopes that the Duke might be persuaded to intervene in the case. As Jamie had not, in fact, committed the crime in question, there could be little evidence against him. It was quite possible that the Duke, a powerful voice among the nobles of England, could indeed arrange to have the charges dismissed. "Why?" I said. "What do you want in return?" The sketchy blonde brows shot upward, and he smiled, showing small white even teeth. "My word, you are direct, are you not? Might it not be only that I appreciate your husband's expertise and assistance in the selection of horses, and would like to see him restored to a place where that skill might once again be profitably exercised?" "It might be, but it isn't," I said. I caught Madame Prudhomme's sharp eyes on us and smiled pleasantly at him. "Why?" He popped the sausage whole into his mouth and chewed it slowly, his bland round face reflecting nothing more than enjoyment of the day and the meal. At last he swallowed and patted his mouth delicately with one of the linen napkins. "Well," he said, "as a matter of supposition only, you understand." I nodded, and he went on, "As a matter of supposition, then, perhaps we may suppose that your husband's recent friendship with a certain personage recently arrived from Rome?" "Ah, I see you understand me. Yes. Let us suppose that that friendship has become a matter of some concern to certain parties who would prefer this personage to return peaceably to Rome. Or, alternatively, to settle in France, though Rome would be better, safer, you know?" "I see." I took a sausage myself. They were richly spiced, and little bursts of garlic wafted up my nose at each bite. "And these parties take a sufficiently serious view of this friendship
to offer a dismissal of the charges against my husband in return for its severance.
Again? Why? My husband is no one of great importance.
Not now, the Duke agreed, but he may be in